girl Jazz Tyler. We are live and direct at the American Family Insurance Studio in the heart of downtown Milwaukee. I would say beautiful, but it's raining up a storm. Raining cats and dogs outside right now. It's not a beautiful sight, not a beautiful day. I'm over it. What's the word, Milwaukee? You have officially been tapped in to the Friday kickback with your girl Jazz Tyler. We are live and direct. We have a lot to talk about today. Got a lot to talk about, a lot to catch up on. It's Friday. Before we get into our national cases today, we're starting right here at home because there are three Milwaukee stories that you have to know about. And we're going to move through this just like any other Friday news rundown. First and foremost, another person has died while in custody at the Milwaukee County Jail. Then two men have now been sentenced in the killing of 33-year-old Corey Fritz, a case prosecutors described as a drug deal that was actually a setup for a robbery. And then we are following the money, because Milwaukee's new five-year financial forecast says that the city could be facing a $52.5 million deficit next year and $104.5 million annual gap by 2031. Talking police, fire department, public works, city services, the sales tax was supposed to help Milwaukee's financial situation. So how are we looking at another $100 million hole? Make it make sense? The math ain't mathin'. Let's start with Tuesday. So a 45-year-old man died Tuesday morning while in custody at the Milwaukee County Jail. This has happened numerous of times. His name has not been publicly released in the reporting I'm using. However, based off of social media, he seemed to be very known, especially in the battle rap world, very respected. According to Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office, deputies picked the man up from the West Allis Police Department 425 Tuesday morning. He was being held on Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office warrants. And according to Fox 6 News, the booking charges included operating while revoked, second offense, operating while intoxicated, operating with prohibited alcohol concentration, and ignition interlock device tampering. Imagine going to jail for that and not making it home, all because you were intoxicated while driving and it had nothing to do with you being hurt with the vehicle or under the influence, but rather because you died while in custody. And this is where the timeline becomes important, because according to the sheriff's office, during the booking, nursing staff at WellPath, the private company contracted to provide health care inside of the county jail, initially medically cleared this man. A secondary medical screening was still pending, so I want you to keep that in mind. And at approximately 4:25 in the morning, deputies picked him up. He gets to the Milwaukee County Jail. He goes through the initial medical screening. He is medically cleared pending the secondary screening. So at 8:30 a.m., well, shortly before 8:30 a.m., the man told jail staff that he had vomited and wasn't feeling well. And the WellPath nurses evaluated him again. And this time, according to the sheriff's office, the medical staff determined that he needed to go to the hospital for additional evaluation. So they ended up calling the ambulance and bringing them in. And two deputies were preparing to escort him to the hospital. But before he could be transported, he experienced a medical emergency. So he stopped breathing. He didn't have a pulse out of nowhere. And the ambulance crew and Milwaukee Fire Department first responders attempted life-saving measures. Obviously, they were unable to revive him, and he was pronounced dead at 9:30 Tuesday morning. So from the time deputies picked him up in West Allis at 4:25 to the time he was pronounced dead at 9:30, we are talking about 5 hours. Who is investigating? The Waukesha County Sheriff's Office is investigating the death. The Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office is reviewing the cause of death. And as of the latest reporting, the cause of death had not been publicly established. So I'm not going to tell you what killed this man because that hasn't been determined publicly, right? And those are facts. But this isn't the first death in custody death. Now, here's why Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service went deeper into this story. According to NNS, this is at least the 10th death of a person in custody and Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office custody, to be exact, since June of 2022. Six of those deaths occurred during a 14-month period covering 2022 and 2023. And then three more occurred in 2025. And now we have this death that just happened August of this year. So again, according to NNS, there has been at least 10 people considered deceased while in custody of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office since June of 2022. Here's another piece of story. An independent audit completed in 2024 identified issues involving several areas inside of the jail. And those issues included mental health services, suicide prevention, and staffing. Now, one advocate who recently toured the jail told NNS that he had seen improvements compared with the condition several years ago. That's important to include, too. But this latest death is bringing the issue back to the public conversation. And the Office of Milwaukee County Executive David Crawley responded to NNS. The county executive office said the cause of death remains under review by the medical examiner's office. But the office said this particular incident does not raise concerns about medical care at the jail and expressed confidence that everything possible was done for this man. Again, that is the position of the county executive's office. The independent investigation and medical examiner review are ongoing. The issue with this here is, if there was a need for him to have a second opinion, a second medical opinion while in custody, then that means that something was wrong initially. That means that the first time they did the review, something was missed. Something had to be missed because there's no way possible that by the time it's time for him to go to the ambulance and from the time when he's seen the nurse the second time that he dies. They missed the steps. So to say that it doesn't raise any red flags is very dismissive, right? And obviously, if I was related to him or, his spouse, I would request an investigation, especially given the track record of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. If they've had 10 people considered deceased within the past, 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 4 years. 10 deaths within the past 4 years. That is absolutely something to look into. Shout out to the chat. Felix said, I knew they were going to be short with the money they got for the budget because they got some money, but not nearly enough. Thank the Republicans in Madison terribly. And they say they backed the police. He is talking about the deficit, and we're going to talk about that as well, Felix. But I want to send huge condolences to this gentleman's family. This is not only sad, but again, it can come off as dismissive, right? If you say that he's seen a nurse and they said nothing was wrong and then he just threw up out of nowhere and y'all take him to another nurse and by the time y'all call the ambulance, he's dead, then yes, something was missed. Or they just didn't care. And let's be clear. We know that things happen. You know, we understand that. But at the end of the day, once they are inside of the custody of the sheriff's department, it is their responsibility to make sure that they are eating, to make sure that they are well taken care of mentally, physically, emotionally, all of the above. Not emotionally, but mentally, physically. Right? So the fact that, again, this has happened raises questions. The fact that 10 people have, been considered deceased within the past 4 years raise another question. And I don't think that this is something that we should look over. Apparently, something is wrong. Something is happening. Something is happening when it comes to the sheriff's office and in police custody. But again, this is nothing new. It's not just the sheriff's office. This is Milwaukee. This is the state of Wisconsin, period. We've had so many in custody deaths over a decade now, you know, all the way going back to the 70s. So again, send my condolences to this gentleman's family and pray that they do seek some type of justice if it is necessary. We are going to take a break right here, but when we come back, I'm taking you into a Milwaukee murder case that reached sentencing yesterday. A 33-year-old Appleton man named Corey Fritz came to Milwaukee for what he believed was believed to be a drug transaction. Prosecutors say it wasn't really a drug deal. It was a setup. They say two men planned to rob him. A struggle happened. A gun went off. Fritz was shot in the head, and prosecutors say one of the men later told somebody Corey had simply hit his head on the mailbox. One defendant pleaded guilty. The other took his case to a jury. That jury needed only about 25 minutes to convict him. Yesterday, both men learned their sentences, and after that, Milwaukee has another problem, and we're following the $104.5 million deficit. We got to go to break. Let's talk about this when we come back. It's your girl, Jazz Tyler, 101.7 The Truth. Truth, award-winning 101.7 The Truth. You are officially tapped in with your girl, Jazz Tyler. Today, we are doing news first. Before the break, we covered Tuesday's death inside of the Milwaukee County Jail, and now we are moving to a case that reached sentencing yesterday, and the victim was Corey Fritz. He was a 33-year-old man from Appleton. The killing happened in March of 2025, and according to prosecutors, what Corey believed was going to be a drug transaction was actually a plan to rob him. So how was this meeting arranged? According to prosecutors and the criminal complaint, Gregory Hamilton and Travis Cooper were involved in setting up the transaction. The deal involved marijuana products, specifically THC edibles. Prosecutor said Hamilton arranged for Fritz to meet him, but according to the state's case, the intention was to rob Fritz. The meeting happened around 43rd and Good Hope on Milwaukee's northwest side. And also, according to the criminal complaint, Cooper later told a witness that he and Hamilton planned to set up the drug deal and rob Fritz. During the attempted robbery, prosecutor says Fritz fought back. Cooper was accused of striking Fritz in the head with the gun. According to the account contained in the complaint, the firearm discharged during the confrontation. Fritz was shot in the head. He was transported to Frederick Hospital, where he died on March 3rd, 2025. Now, here's another detail prosecutors presented. According to reporting on the trial, Hamilton later told a neighbor that Fritz had hit his head on a mailbox. I'm going to say that again. He stated that Fritz had hit his head on a mailbox. Prosecutors said the actual injury was a gunshot wound. Both Hamilton and Cooper were ultimately charged in connection with Fritz's death. That is the dumbest ish I've ever heard. Like, do you not think that the medical examiner's office won't be able to tell that it's a bullet wound? Come on, like, it's like world dumbest criminal. Travis Cooper is 43. He did not take his case to trial. In January, Cooper pleaded guilty to felony murder. So by the time Gregory Hamilton went before a jury this month, Cooper's case had already resulted in a guilty plea. Mr. Hamilton is 45. He was charged with the felony murder, armed robbery as party to a crime. His trial began last week. And on Thursday, August 13th, the fourth day of the trial, the case went into the jury. And the jury deliberated for approximately 25 minutes and returned a guilty verdict. Then yesterday, both men were sentenced to prison. So the Corey Fritz case has now moved from investigation to charges to a guilty plea for one defendant, a jury conviction for the other, and a sentencing for both. Now I want to make a hard turn here because Milwaukee news can't only be about crime. So we got to pivot. There's another story that could affect practically everybody that is listening to me right now, whether you ever step a foot inside a courtroom or a jail or not, because we are talking about city services. Y'all know we all be riding down Burleigh and Center and Lisbon, all those potholes. So we're talking about the streets, police, fire, public works, and our, not yours, our tax dollars. Milwaukee's comptroller just released the city's new five-year financial forecast, and the number at the end of the forecast is $104.5 million. They're saying Milwaukee has a budget problem. Milwaukee City Comptroller Office released a new five-year financial forecast Wednesday, and according to that forecast, the city of Milwaukee is projected to face $52.5 million structural deficit in 2027. That's next year. It's already August. We're going into September. That's not a long way. That's not far away at all. So let me explain what this deficit is in regular language. It doesn't simply mean that the city has one bad bill next year. It means projected ongoing expenses are exceeding projected ongoing revenue. And according to the forecast, that gap doesn't get any smaller. It gets bigger. So apparently by 2031, the comptroller projects the annual structural deficit could reach $104.5 million. And Fox 6 reports that will be equivalent to about 5% of Milwaukee's current budget, right? Didn't we just get a sales tax? Somebody tell me if I'm lying. If I'm not mistaken, we just got a sales tax. And I already know what some of y'all are thinking, right? Exactly what I just said. We just got a sales tax. Milwaukee implemented a 2% city sales tax in 2024. And the comptroller says Milwaukee's reserve fund and other savings accounts are currently in good condition. Yet this five-year forecast still shows a growing structural deficit. So why? One issue is state law. The same legislation that allowed Milwaukee to implement the 2% sales tax also imposed requirements involving police and fire staffing. And those happen to be Milwaukee's two largest departments. So the comptroller's office told Fox 6 that those are departments the city essentially does not have the ability to shrink under those requirements. In fact, staffing in those areas have to grow. So I want y'all to think about that math. You are projecting a deficit. One response to a deficit would normally be to cut the spending. That's obvious. But two of your biggest departments aren't available for the type of reductions that you may ordinarily consider. That puts additional pressure on everybody else. So, Jazz, what does this mean? Yes, I'm talking in third person. What does this mean? And this is why this isn't just a city hall story. When a city starts talking about departments reducing budgets, we're talking about services that we actually use. We're talking about public works. We're talking about libraries. We're talking about neighborhood services, administrative departments, infrastructures, programs, staffs, right? The comptroller told Fox 6 that Milwaukee dozens of departments will likely have to reduce spending, but he also said he doesn't believe cuts alone will close the gap, a gap this large. He says part of the conversation needs to happen in Madison. Here we go with the blame game. Because local government finances are heavily affected by state law and state revenue decisions. So his position is essentially that Milwaukee should tighten its belt where possible and maximize the revenue currently available. But the actions entirely within Milwaukee's control probably won't be enough to close the projected gap. Meanwhile, our mayor, Chevy Johnson, is asking residents for input on city spending priorities. What do we want Milwaukee to protect? And where are we willing to see the reductions? Because those become very different questions when you are talking about a projected $52.5 million deficit next year and potentially $104.5 million by 2031. The issue that I have here, and I don't have an issue with Chevy whatsoever, he actually supports a lot of what we have going on with the youth. However, accountability is accountability. And one thing's for sure, two things for certain. This isn't necessarily about him. This is just me speaking in general. I am sick and tired of the city, the county, the state, whichever organization you choose, asking for the input of the citizens when it comes to the funding, knowing damn well they've already spent the funding or they already have a plan on how they want to spend it. And I get it. It looks good, right? And maybe your intentions is to include the input of the people. Matter of fact, I'm almost positive that the intentions is to include the citizens, right? But the reality is, if what we had to say was that important, we wouldn't have a data center, not just now, but when Walker was in office, because we didn't ask for it then. Crime will be reduced a little bit more. There will be a lot happening. And we, the people, have not seen our input taken into consideration. So now I'm talking to the listeners and I'm talking to taxpayers in the city of Milwaukee. We keep saying, hey, this is what we want. And they keep asking, what do you want? But every time we tell them, it never happens. So we're going in a circle. We are spinning and running in a circle. Don't ask us. Don't ask me what I want if you're not going to take my advice, right? If you're not going to, there needs to be some type of evidence, some type of something put together to where we can go through the years and see how many times we've been asked what it is that we want or to provide input. And let's pay attention to what actually happened, if our input was provided or not. Not to mention, now I got to play advocate. A lot of people who give input about what the issues is in this city are speaking in a subjective manner, right? When we're talking about $104.5 million, we're not talking about just one pothole. Right there on 30th and Center, under that bridge. Y'all know what pothole I'm talking about. We're not just talking about one pothole. We're talking in an objective manner, which means that you have to actually sit down and think about how to spend and utilize these funds, which is also why we put people in office to do that for us. We should understand it, absolutely. But again, we purposely put people in office, people that we trust, so that it can get done. So that's Milwaukee before we even leave home today. Again, a 45-year-old man dies hours after entering the Milwaukee County Jail. An outside sheriff's department is now investigating. Two men have been sentenced in the killing of Corey Fritz after prosecutors said a drug transaction was actually an armed robbery set up. And Milwaukee's own comptroller is warning that the city could be staring at $104.5 million structural budget deficit by 2031. But at 4:30, we are leaving Milwaukee and going back to Mississippi because there are new developments in the Nolan Wells case. The phone, the proposed joint forensics examination, the state autopsy, the CTOIN recording, the boat's GPS, the grand jury, and a timeline investigators are trying to reconstruct from Nolan's final known hours on Horn Island. It's your girl, Jazz Tyler. Do not touch that dial. 101.7 The Truth. One on 1-7 The Truth, it's your girl Jazz Tyler. We are live and direct at the award winning 101.7 The Truth in the beautiful heart of downtown Milwaukee at the American Family Insurance Studio. Hey, listen, before we went to break, we spent 30 minutes talking about all of the incidents taking place inside of Wisconsin, including the deficit that is projected by 2031. Now, it's Friday, August 21st, and we are going to going straight into the news pertaining to Nolan Wells. So for the next 30 minutes, I'm going to take some information, give it to you based on the latest developments. And the first development is Nolan Wells' friends intend to sue Reverend Al Sharpton for defamation. Now, I'm not a huge Al Sharpton fan. I mean, I have my own personal opinions about his involvement in the civil rights movement as an informant, not just against the mob, but against our people as well. However, this is insane to me. It reeks entitlement. It reeks, entitlement and, yeah, entitlement. It's another word I'm thinking of, but I have a brain fart. So, according to NOLA.com, three friends who were with Nolan Xavier Wells before he died on Horn Island plan to sue the Reverend Al Sharpton for defamation. Their attorneys notified the civil rights activist and Baptist minister in an intent to sue letter filed Friday, but gave him time to retract and delete every false and defamatory statement about them, including not limited to those specifically identified in the letter. Mississippi attorney Tyler Cox represents the three friends, Warren Hudson, Jax Pilato, and Morgan Seymour, along with high-profile defamation and media law attorney Edward Andrew Pauzik. In the intent to sue letter, the attorneys allege that Sharpton defamed the trio during a July 4th interview with TMZ and in other remarks he made in the aftermath of the 18-year-old student-athlete's death. The claims include alleged remarks made during the convention for the National Association of Black Journalists and other remarks during a virtual prayer vigil on the National Action Network on August 19th, the day of Nolan's 19th birthday. During the TMZ interview, Sharpton questioned the circumstances surrounding Wells' death and accused the three friends of potentially wrongdoing. Sharpton discussed Wells' cell phone, which was retrieved from the friends after they returned from Horn Island without Wells. He said the phone's photo and text messages had been erased, and all of his photos, text messages, everything on the phone had been erased, according to Al Sharpton. He questioned why Wells was missing without his cell phone and said there were too many unanswered questions surrounding this case. One, he's missing without a cell phone. Two, you lie about whether or not you had the cell phone and Nolan's keys. And three, everything is erased from the cell phone. That's too many unanswered questions for us not to say something is wrong here. This is what Sharpton is saying. In addition, the attorneys pointed to additional remarks from Sharpton, including, I was, first of all, stunned at the fact that this young man is going out. He and three friends, he's black, they're white. And a day later, his mother and them start searching for him. No one comes forward. And then they find out 2 days that they claim his body was washed up and that they had given his cell phone and his keys to one of the three friends, saying he didn't want to go back from Horn Island with them. Have they brought these three men in for questioning under oath? This is what Al Sharpton is saying. The attorneys pointed out those statements and others identified that the three young men he was referring to in his remarks were Hudson, Pilato, and Seymour. You falsely accuse these three. This is what their attorney is saying. You falsely accuse these three completely innocent young men of extremely serious wrongdoing that constitutes multiple felonies under Mississippi law, including but not limited to murder, hindering prosecution in the first degree, and tampering with physical evidence. This is what the letter of the three friends, I don't like to call them friends because they were not his friends. This is the letter of the three boys. This is what their lawyer is saying. There can be no doubt that you were intentionally referring to Warren Jackson Morgan as evidence. It's evident that you are biased. So they're having a lot of back and forth. Nolan's supposed or alleged friends, lawyer, and Al Sharpton are having back and forth about some of the comments that he had made regarding their involvement in Nolan's death. And he's not, again, I'm not an Al Sharpton fan, but everybody knows that the math is not mathing. So today I just want to deal with what's happened since then, right? Because now we're talking about the cell phone. We're talking about the examination, the forensics examination. We're talking about the official autopsy that has been completed but hasn't been publicly released. We're talking about the CTO call, the GPS, and the report from the United Cajun Navy's 22 investigation as well. So on Monday, August 17th, attorneys representing Nolan's family announced that their forensic experts were ready to participate in a joint examination of Nolan's cell phone. The family proposed a window beginning August 18th, and they wanted it to end August 21st for that examination. And according to their attorney, this wasn't a brand new request. So they had already pitched this request or made this request for the examination dates back in July 15th. And the proposed process included forensic experts connected to the government and the family with potential FBI participation. So one of the biggest pieces of evidence in this case remains Nolan's actual device, right? Now, what could investigators potentially obtain from that device? Depending on what's preserved on it, they can get the text message, the call logs, photographs, videos, timestamps, application information, location relation related information, internet activity, and potentially deleted material that remains recoverable. And I want you to remember this detail. Nolan did not have that phone with him when his body was recovered. The phone had returned back to Horn Island with the people that he went with. So the device can potentially provide investigators with a digital timeline surrounding the July 4th incident. And there is another layer to this. The discussion hasn't only been about when the phone gets examined. There has also been discussions about how it gets examined. And according to the correspondence from his family attorneys, issues that needed to be established included the scope of the forensic examination, right? The chain of custody, the preservation, and extracted data. Who gets access to extracted information and how, when, and when Nolan phone was returned. And I was watching a video of one of his so-called friend's mother who stated that she went inside the house asking for Nolan's phone from the gentleman, from the boys he was with, and stated that it took them 15 minutes to get the phone after they said that it was in the truck, which probably is the amount of time. That's the amount of time. Actually, it takes less than that. But in 15 minutes, you can take your phone, especially if it's an iPhone, and erase all the data, all the network settings, all the data, all of the above. But at the end of the day, why did it take 15 minutes? If this is true, why did it take 15 minutes for them to obtain his phone and provide it to the other friend's mother? So moving on from the digital evidence to the medical evidence, the state official autopsy report has been completed. That report has not been publicly released. And Nolan's family also commissioned a separate independent autopsy report. And we have talked about this as well, because by the time his body got to Washington, D.C., we know that some of his main organs were missing, and his throat was one of them. And they needed that in order to dictate if he was choked, strangled, if he drowned, all of the above. So again, there's a lot that's happening, but I think out of all of it, the most important piece is obtaining Nolan's phone. But secondly, it is crazy that privilege, I'm trying to tell you, crazy that these young men, family would actually try to use reverse psychology by suing Al Sharpton for defamation. And you talk about privilege at its finest, right? And baby, if they are guilty and they're going around attempting to sue someone for defamation, I hope it bites them right in their ass. I do. We got to go to break. When we come back, let's finish this conversation. It's your girl, Jazz Tyler. You are live and direct, officially tapped in with your girl, Jazz Tyler, on the award-winning 101.7 The Truth. Welcome back. We are following the Nolan Wells investigation. Before break, we went through the newest developments, including the fact that his supposedly friends are filing a lawsuit of defamation against Al Sharpton, which is very interesting. And not only is it interesting, but it reeks privilege to me. It reeks privilege. Let's jump into this GPS. Mississippi Department of Marine Resources record shows that an officer received permission to examine the Garmin GPS aboard the boat Nolan traveled on. The GPS showed track lines placing that vessel at the northwest tip of Horn Island. That location information was then used by authorities as they worked to establish the search area. That's one digital record. Now add another part of the timeline. So if you've been on social media, you know about this tow call. At approximately 4 o'clock on July 4th, the call was made to Sea Tow from the boat. Sea Tow is a private marine towing service. The caller reported that the boat was taken on water and requested assistance. Now, that recording has since been released publicly, and Nolan's family attorneys have retained experts to analyze that recording. So now we have another time step. Approximately 4 o'clock, the boat trouble is being reported. A call for assistance is made, and experts retained by Nolan's family are examining the audio. Now let's fast forward to 5:54 p.m. At 5:54 p.m., the Jackson County Sheriff's Office established a command post at the Lake Mars boat launch. Multiple agencies became involved in the search. We're talking about the Jackson County Sheriff's Office, Mississippi Department of Marine Resources, the Coast Guard, National Park Service, the Gulf Islands, National Seashore, Mississippi Department of Wildfire. There's about 12 different entities who all participated in this search. And later on that night at 9:52, the MDMR captain emailed the Coast Guard requesting synthetic radar information. Coordinates connected to that request were based on the GPS information associated with the originating vessel. So when we talk about reconstructing Nolan's final hours, we are not only talking about people's memories. We are talking about the potential digital records, the boat, the GPS, the boat GPS, the radar, the phone records, photographs, videos, etc. And it is extremely difficult to conclude this timeline if everything on his phone was erased. Now, what's interesting is I wonder if they are going to attempt to get fingerprints from Nolan's phone. And the reason why I say that is because think about how often you let somebody use your phone. We are in a world today where everybody got a cell phone. Right. Back in the day, you could probably use a house phone or a pay phone or if somebody didn't have a phone. But how often are you asked, hey, can I see your phone right quick? And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because obviously they had his phone, you know, when they left. But if they're able to obtain fingerprints from this phone, I'm interested in seeing how many people actually had his phone. Right. During this process, remember, they had it not only when they left the island, but during the 15 minutes when his other friend's mom requested it as well. Now, let's move on to August 6th. The United Cajun Navy released a 22-page report containing information the organization gathered concerning the search and events surrounding Horn Island. That document includes photos, screenshots from videos, GPS coordinates, and social media statements submitted to the organization. The United Cajun Navy Vice President Brian said the organization received some of that information from people claiming they were on Horn Island that day, which is interesting, right? If you've been following this case, you know that there was a lot of controversy surrounding whether or not other people seen anything. So the fact that they've been receiving information from people, other people who were on that island, makes this more interesting as well. And this is where the timeline becomes important, because investigators can compare what people said happened with digital evidence that has timestamps. So the boat Nolan arrived on ultimately left Horn Island without him. The people traveling with Nolan have said Nolan remained behind and told them he had another way back. So investigators have to reconstruct that period, right? Who saw him last? At what time? Were they on the island? Who was physically near him? What vessels were still there? What photographs or videos existed from that period? And what do their original timestamp show? What does the GPS information show? What does Nolan's phone show? And what does the witness's statements show? Those are factual pieces capable of being compared against one another. And there's a big difference between a screenshot somebody uploads to Facebook and the original data file. An original photograph can contain metadata. An original video can contain metadata. A vessel GPS can also contain tracks. And a phone can contain timestamps. So the deeper this investigation gets into digital evidence, the more investigators can potentially compare human memory with electronic records, right? This is unfortunate that this case continues to be dragged on, so much to the point where these young men and their families, are so arrogant to the point where they actually had the nerve to, sue someone based on defamation. And the reason why I say that is because the case hasn't even been concluded. That's what I mean by arrogance and privilege. The fact that you are willing to take this stance now to me means that, A, you feel like you aren't going to get caught. It doesn't mean that you're not guilty, not in my opinion. Obviously, we don't know. But my personal opinion, I think they had something to do with it. And the fact that they're able to say, hey, we're going to sue you. My mom's going to sue you. My dad is going to get a lawyer. We're going to sue you for defamation. And the case hasn't even been... The case hasn't even been started. It hasn't even gone to trial yet, which means that they still can be ruled as a suspect and potentially be charged. This is not the sign to me of someone who isn't guilty. This is the sign of someone who is privileged, someone who has money, someone who has some type of political power in that state, someone who has access to information that obviously the public don't have based off of a potential cover-up, right? Because when you go back and look at these interviews, those boys don't seem confident. They seem nervous. If you pay attention to the hand gestures and how they're moving and scratching head and rubbing their nose when you're talking and how much... All of this plays a part in it, right? The story's not adding up. They're telling on themselves, saying certain things. And now all of a sudden it's like, hey, we got lawyers now. Yeah, we got a lawyer. So now we go ahead and sue you for a defamation. And the case hasn't even went to trial yet. Man, it's a cold game out here. It's a cold game. Peace. Shout out to the chat. Aaron is him said peace and love, Jazz, and Black community. Absolutely. Peace. Thank you so much for tapping in. And again, I know that on Fridays we typically, you know, it's a kickback. We have fun. We have some fun conversations. But again, there is so much happening. So much happening when it comes to not just Milwaukee, but this country, this nation surrounding Black men specifically, that it will be a disservice for me not to provide you guys with the updates on this information. So Nolan Wells, to his family, again, we send our condolences and pray that this young man seeks the justice. His family continues to seek justice and receive the justice, although we know that justice is never truly served, because you can never get your loved ones back. In the way that the judicial system is built, it doesn't always work in our favor when we are up against white privileged teenage boys and their families. That is just the harsh reality. In a couple of minutes, we are going to go to break and talk about the latest development in the Carmelo Anthony case. This has taken a major turn. Before that, I just want to tap a little bit into the murder trial of Tupac Shakur. I decided not to cover it to its entirety today because looking at the autopsy photos did something to me. And I think anybody with a heart, it did something to. But what was interesting in the testimony today and yesterday was that apparently, and again, we don't know if this is true or, but apparently Dwayne Keefe D. Davis was friends or associates with Suge Knight right before Death Row was created, and that he was a major drug operator. And then Suge ended up taking over these projects that he was dealing out of. And then Suge ended up receiving money from Harry O as well as Keefe D to start Death Row Records. Talk about an interesting turn. In the event that that is the case, this is going to shift the entire murder trial in a different direction. They also mentioned that the same Impala that was seen the night that Pac and Suge got shot was the same Impala that was seen when Biggie got shot. So apparently he was supposed to receive some type of funding from Puffy, some type of funding to assassinate or to murder Tupac, and the money never got to him. But again, the bigger question is, was he really cool with Suge in the beginning? And did he invest some type of funding into Death Row? This is crazy. This is crazy. So if you haven't been watching Tupac's murder trial, make sure you get a chance to tap into that. If you do it for no other reason, do it for the culture. We got to go to break. When we come back, I want to talk about Carmelo Anthony and the things that's happening in his case. There's a development from today in involving text messages, and we're going to talk about it. It's your girl Jazz Tyler, 1017 The Truth.